Rabbi Meir's Simcha Sperling speech.
Okay, Bershus, the Rashi and the Mashkiach, or the Chosh of the Rabbeim. I want to thank Rabbi Jacobson for the skeleton of this shmooze. And I want to begin with a story. The story goes as follows. The phone rings, the father picks up the phone, and he says, Shalom Aleichem, this is your son's Rebbe. He's like, ah, oh, great. How are you? What's going on? He's like, Gevaldik. He said, your son needs medication. This is the end of it. Medication, a lot of it. A lot of medication, starting today. So the father's taken aback. He's like, what do you mean? Is there no other way? Maybe make him like the boy of the week? Medication. Maybe we'll give you medication. Okay. So the parents, they speak it over. They go to the boy. They tell the boy, here's a little bottle of stuff. Candy. It's not nothing about you. And you're going to take it to yeshiva every day. You're going to give one to your Rebbe, and he'll know what to do with it. Gevaldik. 3 weeks later, they get a call. Your son is the best kid in the class. The truth is, the whole class is different. It's just amazing. And I want to thank you for listening to me and understanding, even though it's a difficult, to give your kid, everyone thinks their kids are my kids, right? Gevaldik. So the kid comes home, and the father goes over to the kid, and he goes, like, I want to hear your perspective. Like, how is it? He's like, how's what? How's the candy? He's like, what do you mean? I did what you said. I give one to my Rebbe every day. I put in his coffee every day. Gevaldik. So what's the vart? This is actually, by the way, this is a shayla that they asked Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, who pays for the meds. This is a shayla that came to him. So what's the point of the story? The point is that from the Rebbe's perspective, it was the kid that was the problem. The parents found out really the Rebbe was the problem. Okay, so I want you to hold on to the story as we go through the shmooze, and I think it will be very, very clear. In Parshas Re'eh and Parshas Shmini, we explore, among other things, the signs of kashrus, what makes an animal kosher. There are two signs that make an animal kosher. One of them is that the hooves are split. One of them is that it chews its cud. These are the two signs that make an animal fit for Jewish consumption. Now, what's interesting is, there's nothing to do with Torah, no Makaris, this is Stam zoological science over here, that these type of animals, this category of animals, are the animals that are more calm, that don't devour other animals. They're not called chayas tarfais. They're calm animals. They're submissive, and they're able to be trained easily. Not all of them. The deer is a little bit more complicated. You have to raise it when it's a kid, the whole hawk. But lemaisa, this is the general category. The other animals that don't have these signs, kib, seder, the horse, you could train. Not always exceptions, but in general, the animals that don't have these two signs are more aggressive, are less submissive. They don't subject themselves to humans, and they're harder to train. Domestic, right? They're not domesticated. Gevaldik. This is the division that is seen through history. Nothing to do with Torah. This is Stam science. The question is, why are these the two signs? Is it Stam? These two signs? Whatever. These two signs. So it tells you that it's a kosher animal, or it makes it a kosher animal, depends on the chakira. Or is there a significance to the two signs? Is there something special about these two things that perhaps we could learn from, or perhaps that it's a little bit deeper than just Stam, yeah, Gevaldik. That's the Shaila. Yeah, valid question? I think it's a valid question. Gevaldik, okay. So let's explore this idea. The Ramban writes in Sefer Vayikra and Achrei Mois, I think it's Perek Yud Zayin, as do others, that the cliche that we say in English, you are what you eat, is really not a cliche at all. It's actually fact. You are what you eat. And I'm going to explain with a very shallow example of this, that it could be some of you are aware of, some of you are not aware of, and that is by dieting. If anybody diets here, or somebody's wife diets, or somebody has a sister that diets, you know that there are certain foods that if they're eaten, the next 5 hours, that person is just in a bad mood. They're just lethargic. They become depressed. They become philosophers and start doubting their life. And this is after cheesecake, a little piece of cheesecake. That's it. 5 hours later, don't talk to them. Just aggravated, irritated, angry. If they would have eaten grass, they would have been fine, optimistic. And then, you ever see goats? Goats are always optimistic because they don't do cheesecake. That's the part. Yeah, so on a very shallow level, you see that food taka does have an impact on you. But I want to take it way deeper than this. And that is that the food that a person eats actually goes into your blood. When you eat food, if you know anything about science, about nutrition, when you eat something, it goes into your blood. And your blood knows what to do with it. It transfers it to the veins, transfers it to the liver, to the kidney, wherever it's supposed to go, that's where it goes. And we all know from the Nefesh Chaim, from many Svarim, that the nefesh, the soul, the nefesh, which is part of the neshama, is inside the blood of a person. So the energy that allows you to move, that allows you to go, both physically and spiritually, is in the blood. And the blood is where the food goes. So the food has a tremendous, tremendous impact on all of our psyche, because it's right in the nefesh, it's right there. It changes your disposition. Everything about you is going to be changed by the food that you eat. Now I want to hold that on the side for a second and bring up a new interesting fact. Right, there are those that know history way better than I do, but if you look at Jewish history, there's something that keeps happening over, a quality that emerges again and again and again over thousands of years, and that is that despite the fact that Jews have been targeted by almost every great empire or civilization, I say every because like Australia and Antarctica never like wanted to persecute us, but almost every great civilization, all the Jews, they were pushed for persecution, for abuse, for harassment, sometimes for genocide, absolute murder. And what you would think comes out after an entire, I'm talking collectively now, by the way, for the whole nation of Klal Yisrael, you would think that after time, Klal Yisrael as a nation, as a whole, not one or two, everyone should develop this form of cruelty, of aggression, just to avenge. Like, enough is enough. You know, there are certain people, just ad kan, right? And yet, you don't find such a thing. There are, for those who read newspapers and stuff like that, of a little bit higher caliber, there are essayists and there are journalists and professors who try to explain the culture of suicide bombers. A suicide bomber is sometimes very young, sometimes just married, sometimes with little children. They'll walk into a bus or into a building or wherever the case is, and they'll blow themselves up and kill themselves in the process. Why? What are they trying to gain? They're trying to gain pain, inflict pain in their perceived enemies. That's what they're trying to do, the infidels, right? This started by the Oslo Accords. It got exported outside of Israel, and we all know September 11, and all whatever, it's around the world, unfortunately, a very sad reality. And they come, these essayists, these professors, and they try to explain what's this culture, and they say as follows. They say, what do you want? These people are refugees. These people are oppressed. These people don't know the prospects of freedom. What do you want from them? They don't know what freedom is. They don't know what life is. They're a frustrated people. Of course they want to attack and kill. So I think that's very fast. If that's the svara, then after 6 million Jews are killed from Hitler, Yimach Shemai, there should have been many suicide bombers the next day. The day after the war, it should very well have been that we would have had this desire to kill, to destroy, to literally just revenge. Why not? If that's the lundus, then why not? And I think that if you take a look at Jewish history, despite all this, what's the most important thing in Klal Yisrael is to build, is to seek peace. Oysa shalom b'mreim avuyasa shalom. We say it so many times a day. Building museums, writing books, building families, better education, always building. What's the pshat? I actually saw today, I read this article about this woman who was part of the doctor in Auschwitz. She was one of the twins that they did studies on. And in 19, I think it was like 93, she ended up calling one of the doctors who were from Germany, and she wanted to make a meeting with him, and she wanted to forgive him. So she was explaining, a lot of people weren't happy with this, but she was explaining that she wanted to be free of herself. She wanted to have peace with it. So she wanted to go to the doctor, not him, it was one of the other ones that were there, and say, I forgive you, and that's it. Interesting thing, like you'd think these people would want to just attack and revenge, and no, it's always about building. Why? Where does this come from? Where does this part of Klal Yisrael come from? That no matter, and I'm not saying that there are none. There are people who we know, and we know their names, you probably count on your fingers, the people who Taka became suicide bombers. But in general, collectively, predominantly in most cities and villages, you don't find this. Why not? Why was this never an attribute that we had? Why don't we seek this thing? Why is it always building? Enough of the building already. And when I say building, I mean everything. I mean financially, morally, socially, politically, spiritually, everything. So, Maihai, what's the pshat? So, it could be that part of the answer is the food that we eat. The diet, which is not so healthy, but the diet that we have called kosher, that we've been keeping for 3,300 years, through thick and thin. Right? Even if you're in a mall somewhere, even if you're in a hotel somewhere, and you see all these, like, you always like looking at the guy, and they're so lucky, it's hot in the middle of nowhere, no problem. We have to search all over the place. And I just heard today a quote that there's no kosher place in Israel, whatever it is, right? You know, it's a very difficult thing, and yet we've held on to it strong. We've never ever, I mean, most of us, never ever ate non-kosher. It was always holding on to this diet, and this diet affected our psyche. tremendously. It could be that it even kept us from becoming this way. Perhaps. It could be that there's other answers also, but this is definitely part of it. And I want to take a look into a deeper look into these two signs. Is it stam signs, or is it significance? Is there a significance? So here we go. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu made these two signs, the signs of a kosher animal, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling us that this represents a kosher animal, and these two signs is what represents a kosher human being, a kosher Jewish person as well. These two signs makes you into a kosher person. What do I mean by that? What is split hoofs? What is that? So just agav, funny story, a little embarrassing, but funny nonetheless. When we went to Neretz Yoin, I don't know who went down to the cows and the goats and whatever, but there were cows there. And I already had this in my mind, this shear. Not that I was going to give it here, but stop, I was just working on it. And I thought myself like dealing with the kashrus. So I felt like I was a person who was zeichet maybe miracles. So when I walked into the cows, no jokes by the way. When my wife was like away, I started talking to the cow. I'm like, I would like to see your hoof now. He's like, moo. Nothing. But I was waiting to see, but I couldn't see. He didn't let me see. But Lamai said, if you take a look at the hoof of an animal, you will notice that it is completely split. It's not like this. It's actually completely split all the way down. So much so that you could say there's a right side and there's a left side. There are two sides. Two sides. That's what a split hoof is, if you take a look at it. Now, the first sign, now obviously we all know where the hoof is. It's by the feet. The feet represent movement. Movement is both physical and spiritual. Now, the first sign of being a kosher human, being a kosher Jew, is split hoofs, to have split hoofs. A person moves in life. He moves, like we said, physically and also spiritually. And it's actually a Gemara in Saita. The Gemara in Saita says that the right side we embrace, the left side we push away. We don't. It's not mishmashed. There's a very clear vision. Something's right and something's wrong. And that's how we have to live our lives, that there's a right and there's a left. The first sign of this kashrus is the ability to say that this is healthy and this is poison. This is acceptable, this is unacceptable. This is constructive, this is destructive, right? And that means that whatever the stakes are, it doesn't matter what the stakes are. The fact is, I don't do this. Just a classic example for the olam, nothing personal, just an example for you to relate to it, right? If let's say you shouldn't be going somewhere, right? Let's say Geula. I'm just saying Geula on Fridays, after 12 o'clock. Let's just say, even if the water is cheaper on the top of Geula, even if that's true, and you need 10 cases of water, right? If it's a place you should not be, you should not be there. That's the first sign. If there's a certain restaurant that has better salad, you know, for those who are like the goat, right? So, and it's only there, it's Graden Ben Yehuda, what, right? So in that situation, but we don't do that. No, but the stakes are higher because they only have pizza there. There's no other Danish and coffee anywhere else. You have to go there, right? That's a clear understanding of right and wrong. Yeah, but it doesn't matter because there's right and there's wrong. This is the first sign of kashrus. To be a kosher human being, a kosher Jew, you have to know this I do, this I don't do. It doesn't matter that your friends are going. Or if she wakes you up for chakras, doesn't matter. It's wrong. Something wrong with that. Understand? Gevaldik. That's the first sign. So the first sign of being a kosher Jewish person, kosher Jew, is to have a clear vision of right and left. And this is, by the way, what the first sign of the animal. And when we eat something, we become a little bit affected by that. The second sign is a little bit, a lot of it deeper than the first sign, and that is chewing the cud. The animal chews the cud. It goes down in the two. There's four stomachs. It goes down the whole thing. Ayin chulin. And it comes back up, reevaluated, back down, gevaldik. This is agav no sheiches to the speech. I just figured once I'm here. Anyways, we might as well speak about HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Akaras HaTayev, that a person has to realize that when you digest, that was by an animal, by the way. We don't do this. That's gum. When people do, that's gum. They're chewing gum. They're not chewing their cud. But by people also, we also digest things. And it's important to realize that what goes into this process, the body of an infant when it's born, literally has been to university for 100 years. It has 10 PhDs in nutrition, and the second something touches the saliva, it already starts breaking down. And then it goes down, all while you're walking to Geula to get the water, right? And it's just going down, and this goes to the veins, this goes to the kidneys, this goes, and your body knows all that. It knows how to do all that without you doing anything. You could be sleeping, you could be eating, you could be learning, whatever you want to do. So it's a tremendous thing that we all have to be thankful for. We have to realize that the Eibush, that when we go into supper, it's not just we eat, and the body then has a whole thing. The body's like, I'm good, you do whatever you want. I'll take care of this. Very interesting thing just to realize. But anyways, The animal chews it, goes down, comes back up. What does this have to do with us being a kosher person? What's the lesson? It's a very, very profound lesson. Listen carefully. It manifests its way in many, many different areas in Shalom Bayis, in Rebbe Talmud, in roommates, in friends, in everything. And that is like this. When we digest things, not food, when we digest things, okay? We're digesting ideas. We see something that happens, we hear a good vart, we digest ideas. We digest attitudes. We digest perspectives. In psychology, it's called schemas. We digest all of these different things that goes into our brains since we're little kids. And then our brains create stories from all these different things that we were exposed to that we see. And it puts all of your life's memories and ideas and attitudes and schemas and all these things into one long life story. And then when something happens in your life or you see something, it goes in into the context of what you're familiar with. You get an email like this, you answer it like that. Your friend tells you that, you answer it like that. You know, and each part of your life is in context of what your experiences are, both positive and negative, by the way. Okay? This is a true fact. You could check it up. This is what happens. So we're living our life based on this long story that we're just putting things in where they go. The second sign of kashas, which is to digest your food and to bring it back up again, is the courage and the ability to say that I'm going to bring something back up which was already digested. I'm going to bring it back up for re-evaluation or re-examination and make sure that I chewed it correctly. Often in life, we take things in, it goes deep down, and that's it. We were right. They were wrong. I was right. What does that mean? Take a look at my brain. Take a look at my story. With all the facts that were here, I was correct and he wasn't. Yeah, but you're hurting him. Yeah, what does that mean? But I was right. He was wrong. Right? That's what we do. This is what happens all the time. It happens every second. And I just want to explain that. So it's the courage to bring something back up and rethink it and make sure that Yutaka made the right decision. I think one of the most, the greatest examples of this is one of the famous stories in Bereshis that actually constitutes the whole second half of Bereshis. Okay, there's going to be a little bit of twist on the story. I think we all know, or most of us know, the basic story, but I'm going to bring in very subtle points that I think are very, very kedai. And the reason we're speaking about this now is because we're beginning the Parshas of Yosef. The story of Yosef and Yehuda. Also, before I begin this part, we're talking about Shvatim here. So everything has to be taken with not a grain of salt, a salt shaker. Because we're talking about huge people. We're talking about huge people that we don't understand the Cheshbonos, and these were the Shvatim. This is the foundation of Klal Yisrael. So we're going to explain it from our perspective, but we have to realize who we're talking about. Anyways, Yosef and Yehuda. What happened? What happens is there's a little conflict in the family, and unfortunately Yosef is the one who has to be taken out, and Yehuda is the one, the Pasuk says, Yehuda says, Vayomer Yehuda el Echov ma betza. Ma betza, what benefit is there going to be if Yosef is languishing in the pit? It's not going to gain anything. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, ma mamain. What benefit, what cash money are we going to get? Nothing. Let's sell him. Yehuda is the king, the melech. So everybody saw him as the melech, so they did what he wanted to do. And he said, ma betza, what are we gaining? Let's sell him. So they sell Yosef for a few shekel. They bought shoes and the mefarshim what they bought. But al-Kopanim, Yehuda sold his brother as a slave for a few shekels. Fast forward 21 years. 21 years, Yosef HaTzadik becomes king. He tells them, I'm not letting Shimon out. Bring Binyamin down. Yaakov says, no way. Yehuda says, no way, Yahweh. I'll take care of him. I'll protect him. I'll benefit him. I'll watch over him. And he has to go. Binyamin goes. Yosef sees him. He puts the goblet in the thing, right? We're familiar with the story? Okay, good. Hope so. If not, the little magic says, fine. Anyways, so he puts in the goblet, and then they catch him, right? It was all set up. They bring him back and says, Yosef, this one is going to be my slave. What happens next is astounding. Vayigash elav Yehuda. Yehuda gets up. He goes, how you doing? I'm saying, popped through his armor. I'm saying, it's here. How do you work out here? Whatever. Anyways, Yehuda gets up. Vayigash elav Yehuda. He gets up and he tells Yosef, I'll challenge the entire Mitzrayim. You let him go because my father will die. And then what does he say? What does the pasuk say? Va'ata yeshev na avdecha tachas anar. Take me. Incarcerate me for life instead of him. Whatever you do, don't make my brother a slave. Whatever you do, take me instead. Yehuda, the king, is willing to give up his freedom forever. What happened there? 21 years ago, five shek, sale, you know? Four, okay, go. You know? 21 years later, he's willing to give up his freedom forever in order for his brother not to become a slave. And I want to point out another interesting thing, and that is that according to Yehuda, according to some shitas, there are some people that argue, but according to some shitas, Yehuda did not know of the setup. He did not know that Yosef put the goblet in the thing. So from his perspective, he could have gone to Yaakov and been like, Dad, or like Tati, or whatever, however they spoke, I promised you the well-being of your child, but your kid is sick. Your kid needs to be evaluated. He knew the matzav. He knew the story. We went down there and he stole the goblet. He tried to assassinate the king. Like, fool, please. He stole the goblet of the prime minister when he knew the matzav. You can't take me. If you don't want to be protected, I cannot protect you. Yehuda could have said that. He could have. He probably would have been justified by saying that. Wasn't? Yeah, that's another variant, different perspective, different story. But that's true also. But he didn't do that. He didn't do that. What did he do instead? He stood up. He said, I'm not going to stand for this. You're not going to make him a slave, and I'll be a slave instead. And he could have done that. He literally could have done that. So what changed in Yehuda as an individual? And then after that, Yosef said, I'm Yosef, Glaudek. What changed in Yehuda? Good kasha. Okay. So the Torah usually doesn't tell us straight out, but the Torah gives us a big hint. And that is the story that is right in middle of these two stories with Yehuda and Tamar, which on the surface has nothing to do with anything in Sefer Bereishis, literally. I don't know why it's there. Why is it there? The Torah is coming to tell us something from that story. So what's the story of Yehuda and Tamar? The story of Yehuda and Tamar is that Yehuda had three children. He got married, he had three children, three boys. His oldest boy married a woman whose name was Tamar. He died for whatever reason. Ayin Psukim, fine. His next son, this is something called Yibum, his next son marries her, he dies. Yehuda, not knowing the real reason why they died, blamed it on Tamar. So he said, there is no way that my third son is going to marry this woman. And I'm sure she was an amazing person. I mean, to be the daughter-in-law of Yehuda, that's some heavy yichus right there. So I'm sure she was a special person. But from Yehuda, he's like, there's no way. So he told her, wait till she grows up, gevaldik. So now she was in an impossible situation because she couldn't get married to somebody else. She was literally binding to this child. And she knew Yehuda didn't want to marry. So what'd she do? What'd she do? So Yehuda, his wife died. And now Yehuda's going to tend to his flock. So Tamar is told that he's going there. So she dresses up like a zayna, covered her face. And she went to the crossroads where Yehuda was going to pass by. Yehuda passed by, and we all know the story. Yehuda invites her to a relationship, and she says, how are you going to pay me? He's like, I'll give you a goat, because they're always optimistic, joking. So he says, I'll send it to you. And he says, yeah, but I need something now. I need some collateral. He says, okay, here's my belt. Here's my stamp, my seal, and here's my staff. Okay, we know the story. He leaves, she leaves. 3 months later, she's expecting twins. Everybody sees this. They're like, one second. And the youngest boy is not, they weren't together. So she obviously betrayed the relationship. Yehuda, right? They called Yehuda. Yehuda saw the matzav. He judged the situation, right? He was the supreme justice. So he was the melech. And he said she has to be burnt. She has to be killed, her and two little children. And what happens? The next scene, the pasuk says that she sends the three items to Yehuda, to her father-in-law, and she says to the one who owns these three things, that's the father of these children. Yehuda looks at them, and he says, "Vayakar Yehuda, he recognized it. Vayemet tzadka mimeni. I an uncleus that she was still righteous. She was still a tzadikus." He says, "These are from me. It's my fault. This whole thing." And he got up, and he explained why she did it. He said, "Rabbi Yisai, this is my issue." The whole drama, that it wasn't just like, hey, let's burn it, right? No, it was like a whole thing that to set it up. That everybody found out about it. And Yehuda stood up and he said, it was my fault. I was the one who's the father of these children. Now, besides the integrity that Yehuda displayed, which is, by the way, one of the reasons that kingship, that the malucha, that Mashiach goes to him, is that we know that power, when you're powerful, it corrupts you. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. So a melech, somebody who's such a great person, is for sure going to be only somebody who is able to stand up in a minute of truth and say, it was me, tzadka mimeni, that is somebody who Mashiach could come from. Tremendous. But besides that, I want to ask you another question. By the way, if we run late, you could leave early. I'm not, I'm going to try to push it as fast as I could. Besides that, I want you to think about something else. And that is, when Yehuda sent her to be burnt, what do you think went through his mind at that second? I'll tell you what I think. I think he thought he was the most righteous person in the world. He was doing the right thing. He was following the Torah. He was protecting immoral conduct. I mean, she betrayed the relationship. This has to be done for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not for me. I'm not vindictive. He wasn't out to get her. He thought he was 1,000,000,000% correct. What happened 20 minutes later? He looks down, he sees these three things. What do you think he said in English before he said, Tzadka Mimeni? Oh my gosh, these are mine. Wait a minute, you mean, and he's, what, right? That's probably what happened. He was thinking 20 minutes ago, I was the tzaddik of the generation. 20 minutes ago, I was the righteous, just the supreme. I was doing everything correct. There was no way I made a mistake. I literally looked at everything, and she had to be burnt. This is not for me. 20 minutes later, you were so wrong. So wrong. You didn't even know how wrong you were. What do you think that does to a person? And by the way, there's no shaila that all the WhatsApp and hashtags and chats and in the mikvah, not the Shinsky because you can't talk there, but the place that you could talk, and all the Shabbos tables, there's no question that they were hacking what happened. There's no question. There was no cover given to him, that for sure. No, and still he stood up. And he could have done things different. He could have found a way to, you know, to make her free from halacha. Oh yeah, the halacha says here that if it doesn't have to be burnt, well, Baldik, he could have done that and had iced coffee and been good. She's good, I'm good. He didn't. He stood up and he embarrassed himself and no cover was given to him. He saw that he was wrong. So wrong that he had no clue how wrong he was. What do you think that does to a person? That rocks your core. That's what that does. That literally shakes you to your core. It makes you a different person. When that happens, that you are so off and it's exposed and you know, and you're like, whoa, I cannot believe that I made such a big mistake. That rocked him so much. And he said that from now on, I am not being the same person. And that means when the years and years later, Binyamin was now threatened as a slave, because it seems, if you looked at all the angles, it seemed very clearly that he stole and he could have been justified, as we said. He didn't do that. He said, no, we're doing things differently this time. Don't take him, take me as a slave. Because maybe, just maybe, it's not true. Now what happens, what else was in Yehuda's head? I think maybe he was also thinking about Yosef. Maybe that time I also made a mistake. Maybe by Yosef I also, even though we saw all the angles, murdered the Malchus, right? Maybe, just maybe I made a mistake. And then Yehuda went down, Binyamin, this, and we found that Itaka didn't steal. And Yosef saw there was healing in the family. He said, oh, this is the same Yehuda who sold me. Now he's standing up. Vice says he changed. I'm Yosef, by the way. Now that we're healed, Givaldik, we can make a kiddush. I think this is a very good example that classifies as chewing your cud. You take something in, you thought you were right, you thought you had everything figured out, and you bring it back up for re-examination. I think this is a very clear example of this. Now, I just want to give you one classic example before we finish up with how we should change ourselves. Just, I want you to all picture yourself in Shtibalach or in one of these shuls, and you're davening, and you just heard a shir on Chassidim, how Gevaldik Chassidus is, and you see a guy in the front Chassidish, he just finished Menesrei, and he starts taking off his tefillin. And you're like, ah, classic, classic. After Menesrei, leaving early, Chassidim, yeah, Gevaldik. And you're standing like, so who knows, who cares if he knows how to learn? He's leaving early. I don't leave early. Gevaldik. And then he picks up the second pair of tefillin and you're like, I was talking about him, second pair, him, third pair. Like, you're stuck. You thought you were right. You thought you were correct. And you were dead wrong, dead wrong. Now, how does this apply in our lives, besides for that case? Yeah. What it does is that when things happen in our lives, whether it's with Shalom Bias, our wives, she said something, and how could she say that? Doesn't she know I love her? I paid the bill, right? And with our Rebbeim, yeah, that Rebbe, okay, first of all, right? And Rebbeim with Talmidim, yeah, he needs the meds. The Rebbe needed the meds, understand? Right? The family and students and friends and roommates and Shabbos and the off Shabbos, who's coming, who's not coming, who should we add, who should we not add, car, small car, big car, all these different things, right? When these things come, the yesod of this kashrus is not to make decisions in the heat of anger, in the heat of the moment. It's to swallow it from one angle, bring it back up, re-examine. Wait a second, how is he going to feel if I say that? How is he going to feel if I do that? And you re-examine and you try to get every perspective, not just my perspective. And I think this is the way that we could learn in our lives how to do it. And we have to know that every person has blind spots. Somebody is once told, he's like, what should I do? I have this, I have that. So he was told, he's like, listen, are you not masking you have blind spots? He's like, I know I have blind spots, but I know my blind spots. You can't know your blind spots. They're blinding. It doesn't matter how expensive the car is. Every car has blind spots. You understand? So even though you think you're right, and you probably, maybe you are right, but maybe, just maybe, you're wrong. And I just want to finish with one story. One story. If I don't make me. Very quickly. The Ksav Sefer was the Chassam Sefer's son. When he became Rav, it's a very famous story. When he became Rav, he made a big celebration, and he brought a coin to the celebration. It was a Machzitz HaShekel from the times of the second Beis HaMikdash. And he thought it would enhance the celebration, not he thought it would. If he shows it to everybody, so he gave the coin to the first person, and, you know, it went around, the gorgeous coin, Gedaldik, and it was supposed to make its way back to him, but it never waited, it never came back. He's like, one second. He's like, lock the doors. They locked the doors, and he said, I'm really sorry to do this, but I need the coin. Everybody empty your pockets, and let your friend testify that you do not have my coin. An old man lifts up his hand, a very prestigious person, who is actually a contemporary of the Chassam Sefer. He said, maybe let's look for 15 minutes before we do this. He's like, okay, I hear that perspective. They looked for 15 minutes. They didn't find it. Please empty your pockets. Another 15 minutes. After 2.5 hours, the Ksav Sefer said, that's it. This is the last 15 minutes. Okay, that 15 minutes, they found it. It was in one of the dishes that the waiters by mistake took to the sink, and they found it. Gevaldik. He let everybody go, and he went over to the Ksav Sefer, the Rav, went over to the old man. He said, my hi, what were you doing? He said, I'll tell you what I was doing. I also have a Machzitz HaShekel from the second Beis HaMikdash. And I brought it here so we could enhance the celebration, but I saw you had one, so I kept it in my pocket. When it got lost and you said, everyone empty your pockets, I knew that when I empty my pockets, you're going to find it. And what am I going to say? I'm going to say, it's mine. And you'd be like, no, it's not. Please pass it back here, right? Because of Busha, we understand Busha. And I would fight for my life and say, no, it's mine. That's really mine. I brought it here. In the same room, come on. No, it's not yours. And not one person, not one in this entire room, including the Rav, would have said or looked at it from another perspective. Not one. Every one of you would have looked at me and my family for the rest of my life as a thief. And therefore, I kept saying maybe 15 more minutes just in case we would find it and I would protect myself. I think this is another classic example of chewing your cud. Even though you think you're 100% right, whether it's in marriage, whether it's with your talmidim, with your friends, with your rabbim, you think, and you're even older, and it's your son, so like, how could he know more than you? Just maybe, you're wrong. We should all be zeicha, Mirtz Hashem, to have the courage to be able to chew our cuds and have split of geula, by the way. This Friday, I'll be there. No, but we should all have the courage, Mirtz Hashem, to be able to stand up in the minute of truth and be like, wait a second, maybe, just maybe, I was wrong. Shkoyach.